Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free.
I used to have a thing of arrogance who was in the chat room, can't say now.
So take my hand. This land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We're here just with Kirk and I this evening. How are you, Kirk?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you.
And the eyes are both focusing these days, no light and dark spots?
Actually, 20/20 now. That's great.
Oh, my. That is spectacular. Particularly for an artist, that's a really good thing. I understand that Terry is still under the weather. We do not have JB this evening. He is celebrating. He was awarded the job that he had interviewed for. So he has a bigger opportunity and more responsibility and greater compensation that goes with all of those sorts of things. So that is really good news. What I wanted to do is just kind of give you an update as to where I am in terms of writing, then we'll jump back into to this account of Sodom and Lot and Sodom. It is a remarkably different story, as we know, than that which we have heard. I'm really glad that I didn't attempt to do this translation in the first 17 years, I think, of doing the translations, and that I waited to later, because this one, it takes some thoughtfulness. Right now, I'm in the process of translating the first 7 Mizmor Psalms. I completed a chapter about a week or so ago that is the first volume of Volume 3 of Observations of Our Time, that's now called The Second Coming. And we playfully hinted at, you know, what that might entail, but it is it's based on the first 3 Mizmor Psalms, and they're really moving. The thing that was the I'm just gonna let one cat out of the bag, if I may. The first word that Dod wrote. So, you know, Dod is, and we're going to find this out as we go through these first 7 Psalms. Dod's the guy. I don't care what argument somebody wants to foist, but Dod is the only person Yahweh anointed. And the word for anoint is Masiach, which is the word that is transliterated Messiah. So if you're looking for a Messiah, there's only one that Yahweh himself anointed. It's Dod. Dod is the only person whom God said, he is my son, I am his father. There's only one person that Yahweh, well, there's two people that actually Yahweh said they can be king, but only one of those that God was so impressed with his ability to lead his people that he's bringing him back. It's going to be the kingdom of Dod for 1,000 years. Who knows how long thereafter. So there's some things. Like, for example, those, the only person that Yahweh said, that dude, he's Sadak. He's right. Now, I will tell you that getting into, I think it was the second or third psalm, and having to learn about some of Dode's later life mistakes. There's some things that Dode does that, you know, I don't like at all. And yet, you realize that God loved him. And it is the most reassuring thing of all, really. Because what it means is that the garment of light that Yahweh provides for those who are set apart and become members of his covenant family blinds even God of what we do that isn't perfect. He saw Dode as a beacon of light. Because when Dode was inspired to write, he was a beacon of light. When Dode was dealing with his relationship with Yahweh, he was always brilliant. God didn't see the rest of it. And it bodes well for us, because I would like my relationship with Yah to be based upon the best I'm capable of, the best I've ever done, and not on the worst. But this is the part I was going to get to. All right. I'm going to give you one guess. If you could sing to my heart, this is really personal now, and maybe it should be personal with everybody, because I don't think there wouldn't be a single one of us here, not one of us, if it wasn't for this word. What do you think is the first word that Dode wrote in the first psalm?
Asher. Asher.
That is it. Yep. Asher with a Y after it, so it's Asher with Yahweh's hand.
With Yahweh's word.
Yep. Asher. And he repeats the word Asher without Yah's hand twice more in the opening stanza.
Hey, she missed it.
Isn't that something?
Uh-huh.
You know, here, I think we're the first in probably a better part of 3,000 years who have recognized how important Dode is to our understanding. And Dode begins his literary relationship with Yahweh with the same word that brought us all together. That's pretty cool.
That is very cool.
Yeah, when I was dealing with that several weeks ago, I just broke down. It was just, that was really a poignant moment. And then he proceeds to go through, and these first two Mizmor in particular, he just goes through everything that we have battled, you know, because I think we're the first to say that the initial step to the covenant requires us to do what Abraham did, what Noach did, what Moshe did, what everyone has done that has been part of God's family, which is to walk away from religion and politics, to walk away from Babel. And that's how it begins. That's how his story begins. Walk away from the ways of man and celebrate the Torah. And then today, with man's fastest growing and I think most debilitating religion being conspiracy, the second Mizmor opens with God saying, what in the hell is wrong with you with these conspiracies? What on earth are you doing this for? This is just ridiculous. Stop it. So it's really interesting. I can't wait for us to jump into it. We'll have to get back in the sequence of things, because we haven't really gone over the last volume. Now, this is the second to last volume of Observations for a Time, and we still have to go through the last volume of it. And I think we even jumped ahead to get where we are. It's going to be some work before we get there, but it is a...
Well, we always play
it's a thrill.
We always do a sidebar.
Yeah.
One Friday and do Psalm 1.
Yeah. Yeah, I've sent it to you, haven't I? The first chapter of Volume 3. And the second chapter, Dode gets, by the time we hit the fourth Mizmor, Dode is, he's pretty much out there. He's making the kind of statements that we have made of him. You know, saying, you know, you need to pay attention to me.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of himself, he's talking to God and talking to us as if he, to a large degree, holds the keys.
Yeah. He knows he's right.
Yeah, he knows he's right. And he does hold the keys.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, he holds the keys. It's...
You know, that's why it makes it, to me, it makes it more, the acknowledgement now that I'm sure we're right about is that Dode is doing this, but most of this is for, beyond doubt, for Yehudim and Yisrael in the last few years, which is around the corner. I mean, it doesn't resonate with Christians. They absolutely hate what you're saying.
Right. Oh, because if you're looking for a Messiah, you need to look at Dode.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a Messiah, that's the guy you look to. That's the guy that Mashiach, as a title, is applied to Dode. It's not applied to Yosha. You know, it's in one of these chapters, Kirk, we were confronted with something where Dode made a statement that was just knock you on your heels in terms of his overall importance. And, you know... Trust me when I say this. If God's going to choose him, a man, to establish a 1,000-year reign when God himself is going to be in the center of Jerusalem, and yet he is establishing a kingdom of a man while he is here on earth in the center of Jerusalem, that dude's important.
You ain't kidding. That's what we call being in high cotton.
Oh, man, that's so far beyond high cotton.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why, and if you look at the Jews for Jesus, which is the fastest growing religion in Israel, and you look at their website, their opening page is Zechariah 9. And it's this prophecy. And they're saying that prophecy is Jesus. No, it isn't. It's Dode. God cannot give the world to Yosha. You know why he can't give the world to Yosha?
Well,
because he promised it to Dode.
To Dode, well, yeah.
He can't make Yosha king of anything on earth because he's already promised that to Dode. Sorry.
Right.
And so I went through and I was saying, you know, that listen, to diminish Yosha in favor of Dode is exactly what God wants. Exactly.
Yeah.
God is not pretentious. If God was pretentious, none of this stuff would be the way it happened. You would not have God, if he was pretentious, communicate anything he had to say through Moshe, a stutterer, through a teenager in I'm Way Too Young, Yirmiyah, through Yashaya. He's not doing it through any person. He's going to do it himself if he was pretentious. But he's not. And so if you realize that Yosha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, at least was during the last 3 years, God chose somebody who wasn't beautiful, a manifestation that he himself could see to it, was destroyed. That's what he did. The Pesach lamb has to be destroyed for its fulfilled Pesach. Yosha came for a singular purpose, and it wasn't to reveal God's nature to us.
No.
It wasn't to teach us anything. It wasn't to communicate with us. Do you think that if it was God's intent for Yosha to communicate something that was important for us to know, that we would have like a few sentences of what Yosha said in the language that he actually spoke it, retained in a credible way, where there's like manuscripts that we could read that go back to that time that were written in Hebrew?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have that for the Torah and Prophets and Psalms.
Okay.
You know, with Dode, you have the better part of 170 Mizmor, 40-ish Mashal. All as he wrote them in Hebrew, most of which retained in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you don't have a single word from Yosha? Not one? Even if it were God's intent that we learn something from his words, we don't have them. And I'm here to tell you that you're just better off throwing away the books of Luke and Mark.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have them. So Yosha didn't come here to tell us what we didn't know. In fact, when he talked, who did he quote?
He quoted Moshe, Dode.
The Torah and the Prophets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. When it's the similar moment of his life, the purpose for which he came, Dode is quoted. Yosha quotes Dode. You don't have Dode quoting Yosha.
No.
So we can learn profound insights from Dode because they were written down for us to contemplate. We don't have that from Yosha. Yosha came to fulfill Pesach. He's the Lamb of God. If he doesn't fulfill Pesach, we don't have a prayer. We're done.
No.
We're cooked. Really, really important. And he played a role, obviously, but it's really Yahweh's soul, a nefesh, that endured matzah. And it's a combination of the set-apart spirit that facilitated Bukurim and Shavua. So, his mission was profoundly important. God said, I myself will supply the lamb, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
And when you celebrate Pesach, is it our job to worship the lamb?
Absolutely not. We eat the lamb for nourishment.
No. Do we tell that lamb, God, lamb, I am so glad that you're doing this for me?
No.
No. No. So, when you think about it, it becomes really self-evident that God's not looking for us to be Jews for Jesus. He's not looking for us being messianics. He's not looking for us to be Hebrew roots, but certainly doesn't want us to be Christians or rabbinic Jews. He doesn't want us to make a concoction that's two parts Pauline Christianity and one part rabbinic Judaism. And I think we've the cat's meow.
Mm-hmm.
Just blended together of lies. If you want to know what causes a man to be tzedak, right, and therefore vindicated, pay attention to what Dode said. If you want to know how one develops a relationship with God such that the creator of the universe says, you are my son, you are my daughter, you are my child, and I am your father, then I've got some advice. Listen to Dode. But what's so amazing is that the Zechariah 9, is it's talking about this prophecy that people get all wrapped up in their panties over, thinking that it's Jesus. It says that you're going to inherit a kingdom that goes from sea to sea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what?
I'm
sitting here translating the Psalms, and right here in the Psalms, God, long before Zechariah would be inspired, Yah is telling Dode, when you return as king, you're going to inherit the lands of the Gentiles. You go from sea to sea.
Verbatim? Wow.
Yes. Verbatim. And it's just like when we were dealing with Yeshaya 9, the thing that, you know, is in all the Christian carols, mm-hmm. where it says, you know, that in his name shall be, and that he shall be. And we went over it, and one of the key words, there is a reason that ethnic Jews rejected Yosha, and that is they had read the Yeshaya 9 prophecy, and they knew that this individual was going to be a Gibor. He was going to be a mighty man, a warrior, a man of great valor. Yosha wasn't a warrior. Never fought a battle. Wasn't a military commander. He was the last thing from a Gibor. That's why they didn't accept him. That's why they didn't recognize him. That's why they did recognize the warlord, Bar Kokhba. Because he was a Gibor. Dode was a Gibor.
Wow.
That's a military man. He's a lot of things. I mean, the most inspired writer of all time. But
you put it all together like this, wow.
But when you read that prophecy in Zechariah 9, which is included in that chapter, it is absolutely evident that the person he's talking about is Dode. And the reason that so many people get fooled into believing that it's Jesus is because he'll be riding on a donkey. People don't even bother to look. Is Dode ever once associated with a horse or a camel?
No.
Not once.
No.
When Dode was going to be responsible for getting bread out of Bethlehem, well, by the way, guess where Dode came from?
Bethlehem.
That is correct. When he was responsible for delivering bread, what animal was that bread delivered on?
Well, I'm sure it's a donkey.
When Dode said, okay, God has arranged it that my son, Solomon, is going to be the next king. And he needs to ride into to town for, you know, his ordination. Proud. What did he give him to ride?
Sure, it's a donkey.
He said, give him my donkey. Let him ride my donkey. Yeah. I was of the, you know, the passage in Yeshaya that we've covered before, where Christians are all saying, well, yeah, this has got to be speaking of Yosha because this speaks of the virgin birth, and it was saying that, you know, a virgin shall conceive. That's the sign I'm going to give you, and he was talking to someone God, you know, hated, the king that God just despised, and as you know, it is Yah's style to yank the chains of those that he despises. You know, that's why he gave the sign of Yonah to the rabbis who were questioning him. This is the sign I'll give you. And they didn't have a clue. It would take us 2,000 years later before we'd figure it out, what he was saying. But with the Yalad Yaled, that a young woman is going to give birth to a boy child.
Yep.
That's what it says in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in Yeshaya. Okay. Big whoop, huh? Some prophecy. Run the odds on that. A woman's going to give birth to a son. Big whoop. Saying in Zechariah that the king is going to ride a donkey is like saying a woman is going to conceive a child. All of Israel's kings rode donkeys. The only time they would ever be on a horse is they're going off to fight a war, period.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they rode donkeys. So to say, no, you're going to ride a donkey, that's like saying, you know, I need to get across town to go to the store, and I predict I'm going to ride in a car.
Yeah. Damn, you're good.
Some prophecy, huh? Yeah, I'm good.
You know my first point?
It's just amazing. Wow. Why we don't think. And you know what's really interesting about this is that, of course, the Christian wants to have him humble. You know, they love having a humble God, humble and riding on a donkey, and yet they want to lift him up in praise. Now, if he's humble, why would you lift him up in praise? But Dode, who is the center of the universe from God's point of view, David, he's making some bold statements in the first form five Mizmor. And you'd say, wow, anybody else make that statement and you'd be, want to tone down the ego at the door. I mean, you're not going to get your head through. And yet there's not a hint of ego in it. One of the statements that I translated this morning was, Dode is asking, for how long is everyone going to diminish my significance?
Really?
How long is it going to be that you're going to devalue what I have to offer? I know the answer. 3,000 years is how long. 3,000 years is how long that they're going to devalue Dode. And you might say, oh, that's not fair. The Israel flag is the Star of David. David didn't have a star.
And no, he never had a star. He wouldn't have a star.
I was getting my hair cut today, and my barber was a Israeli. He grew up in Jerusalem, Yerushalem. His name was Hanan, and I told him, no, it's not Hanan. Your name is Chanan. No, he said, it's Hanan. I said, no, it's not. It's Chanan. And this is what it means. But anyway, so I'm having, you know, the man holding a razor to my my throat as I'm and as I'm telling him, no, I know that you're fluent in Hebrew. I understand where you were born and raised, but I'm here to tell you this is what the words mean. And we, you know, talked about God's name and everything else, but it is truly amazing just how they just don't know. We were talking about Dode's name. And I said, what I've come to know, he mentioned Jesus. And I said, no, there's no Jesus. There's a Yosha. But what I've come to realize is that there's somebody vastly more important, especially for Yisrael and Yehuda. And that's Dode. He says, you mean Dawid? And I said, no, I don't mean Dawid. He said, but that's how it's pronounced. I said, no, it's not. It's DWD. It's based upon the verb and the noun meaning to love and be loved. And the word that it's based upon is DWD is Dode. There's only one time in 1,000 times that the name appears that it has a Y in it for the id at the end. One. The other, 700-800 times it doesn't. And, you know, I've gone through it, as I told him. So how do you pronounce the book that Moshe was associated with? Oh, Torah. Well, where do you think you get the O?
Yeah.
What do all Jews say to each other when they greet one another?
Shalom. Shalom.
Shalom. Where do you think you get the O?
Yeah.
When you talk about Elohim, and you know it's from Eloah, where do you get the O?
Yeah.
And so it's Dode. He may not like the sound of it, but that's that's
yeah.
Just it. Yeah, beloved. Yeah, pretty amazing. So anyway, let's return to Lot and the story of Sodom. But I guess what I wanted to share is that we've once my life really settled down. I went through phases. I went through a separation, and during the end of that separation period, where we're kind of in reconciliation, which did not go well, there was I didn't write as much. And immediately after the separation, I moved down to Florida, and I was kind of all over the place, didn't spend a lot of time writing. And about 4 months ago, I got to the point where I'm back now doing it 8-10 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes seven. I can do it 7 days a week because this is not an ordinary job. But, you know, I've ended up writing two chapters out of the one chapter we're on right now, which is chapter 11 of volume 2, which is the story of Moab. So we're telling this whole story of Lot because it's the story of Moab and who and what Moab represents, because Moab plays a really big role in end times prophecy. And then I'm completely rewrote and retranslated, and we've already gone through it prophetically, the chapter Yeshaya 17, which is puts together the timeline of exactly what's going to happen here you know, not that many years, something around 7-8 years from now. And then completely rewrote Yeshaya 18, which exposes and condemns America's role in the destruction of Israel. Attempted destruction of Israel. As a matter of fact, today Trump was in the news reaffirming against all reason that it's appropriate to sell $100 billion worth of advanced weaponry to Saudi Arabia. I went back and I completely rewrote the chapter on Moab because I had started Volume 3 and I started it in Yirmiyah 48. I was going to do 48 through 51 because it covers much of the same material and does a beautiful job of explaining what Babylon is and come out of her my people that is so essential to what God is calling his people from and to. And it begins with Moab again. And so then I went back in and turned that chapter into about a 150-page chapter. But there's something that clicked, Kirk, and it didn't. I'm sure it's not going to click for everyone.
Yeah.
Because this chapter we're going over right now, which is chapter 11 of volume 2, the chapter on Moab, it is written very differently than anything I've written before. I'm going to preface this by saying most people who read it, even covenant members, mm-hmm. are going to see it only as different, tougher to read. Long, complicated. The chapter is called Where the Torah's Voice Died. They're going to see it as long, and they're going to see it as complicated, and they're going to see, oh my goodness, you're following so many stories, and all of these. Why do all of these stories need to be told just to explain who Moab is? And so it's make no excuse for it. It is long. It is complicated. You're not going to read it as your bedtime story late one evening and think you know I'm going to process it. No, you're going to have to be on your game to read it. But something, and that's the reason we're going through this chapter differently than, Kirk, than anything we've done on, you know, we've been doing Yada Yada Radio now for probably 12 years. This is the first time where I've actually read my commentary.
Well, you can get lost in all this if you don't.
But that's not the reason I'm reading it.
Yeah.
I go back now, and I read this commentary in this chapter and then what was written in the in chapter 1 and now chapter 2 of volume 3. Mm-hmm. And the insights and the appeal are so far beyond anything that I've experienced in the past that I just want to share it. I feel the need to share it as it was conveyed. And so that is the reason we're doing it differently than we've done it in the past. There are, it's almost as if I've settled into a role that I did not want to play and have said, all right, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep focused on the mission. The mission is to call Yisrael and Yehuda out of Babylon. And there are three Babylons: geographic Babylon, religious Babylon, and political Babylon. to call Yisrael and Yehuda out of the three Babylons back home, such that they disengage from religion, politics, militarism, from conspiracy, and they embrace the covenant, embrace the Torah, embrace Dod as their king. And that's one of the things that's interesting about Zechariah 9. It says, your king is returning to you. Well, the only king that Yisrael and Yehuda had, I'll tell you for sure, that is returning is Dod. And so, it's extraordinary what we're up against and what the mission is, which is to awaken Yah's people and to call them home. And to do so at a time where the fastest growing religion worldwide is conspiracy, and the number one conspiracy is blame the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Easy target, they think.
Yep. So as the sun...
Before you jump in, can I just ask you something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Last week, I haven't been able to do a whole lot, but last week I did 1914, and this week I did 1915. And I'm finding things that are very odd, good, but I didn't expect to find, because I've looked these words up for years now, and like in Shukar in 1915, it is packed with so many meanings that are relative. If you read what you write in the commentary, you know, the whole thing, and then you went back and looked at it, and you look up something like Shukar, and I'm not as deep as you are with as many options to go to, but I'm finding both with the grammar and this that it'll say things that I never saw before that are totally
to
the theme of what you're saying or to the commentary. I even found this one I found us with Snatched Away and Paul's terms for the rapture, and then I looked up rapture in Greek, and my God, it just goes on and on and on, and you say...
I was going to begin in
Bereshit
19:15, but is there... You mean to read 19:14 and let you...
Right now.
Okay, so I'm going to share 19:14 and let you run with the words that you found, and then we'll do 19:15. Now, the enveloped and entangled. That's the name. That's what the name Lot means, enveloped and entangled. There's a every name that God gives, there's a reason he's giving it. And to be entangled speaks of a web, and we're going to actually go through the substance of a spider's silk and how a web is woven to understand why God chose this name for this man. He never got out of the trap of Sodom. He walked out of the city, but he never left it. He was enveloped in it. He was entangled in it. He was wrapped way too tightly and intertwined. That's what Lot means. And it helps us understand the character that Lot's playing. Lot is being spared for a very short period of time, not because of Lot. He is not being spared because he was a righteous dude. You know that whole argument, what if there's, 100, what if there's 10, what if there's 1? You certainly wouldn't destroy the place if there's a righteous dude down there. Well, Dod's not that righteous dude. God is not sparing Lot because he had his act together. He's sparing Lot for one reason.
Well, it explains it.
Abraham.
For Abraham's.
The only reason he's sparing him is for Abraham. Abraham asked God if he would do this, and God said, yeah, I'll do it. Now, God was going to do it anyway, because this story is extremely important for us to understand. But the motivation isn't for God to be able to enlighten us through this story. The motivation was for God to show Abraham was God's friend. He doesn't call Abraham his son. Abraham was God's friend. He befriended him. And through this friendship, we are given access to the covenant. And the thing that is important here is that Abraham, other than explanations, you know, I don't understand this, could you explain that to me? Other than asking questions that he did so kind of in a strange way. The only thing that really that Abraham had asked of God previously is it possible that my servant from Damascus? Oh, I guess he asked too. What about, can my servant from Damascus be an heir? No. Ooh. How about Ishmael? Can Ishmael, well, that'll work out great. We already got him.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. So now Abraham has learned a thing or two, and Abraham's taking a walk with God. They're chit-chatting, and he looks down, and that's where his nephew is, down there in Sodom. And God says, I want to destroy the place. And this time, you notice Abraham saying, well, can my nephew be part of the covenant? Doesn't ask that, does he? Mm-hmm. Just, will you spare the place for one individual? So it was important to Abraham that his nephew be given an opportunity. Keeping in mind that part of what this story is all about is the fractured family of man and how badly human families are fractured, including Abraham's family, badly fractured. And that sometimes we can want the best for someone, and we can even go way out of our way with God and with them to give them an opportunity to get their act together. And it's just not going to prevail. It didn't work with Lot. Yeah, Abraham bought time for him. He pleaded with God, got him released from Sodom. But it went downhill after that. We just don't always prevail in the human family as part of the story. Okay, so now the enveloped and entangled went out and said to his sons-in-law, which is kind of an interesting that it was sons-in-law because, you know, the daughters, you know, are presented as virgins. But now it's sons-in-laws. That means that they're married, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it helps reinforce the translation that I had earlier, that he wasn't offering the town the opportunity to rape his daughters. Yeah, he was using his daughters as a contrast, as a window for understanding. Not to be taken sexually. It gave no opportunity and no inference that that was the case. And this furthers it. It doesn't say they didn't know any man, as in they were a virgin. These are sons-in-laws. No, it is about they were had rejected lo yada, the ways of man. The daughters had. So he said to his sons-in-laws, who were to obtain his daughters, I wrote it that way, but there's no past, present, or future tense in Hebrew. So it could just as easily, who had obtained his daughters, who had grasped hold of his daughters. Laka means to receive, to grasp hold of. So whether it's past tense, future tense. And what's really interesting, because it can't really be future tense, because guess what? Those boys didn't make it out of Sodom, did they?
Get out of the town, no.
No.
Want
to go? He said, get up. Get up. You're going to want to get out of this place, because Yahweh is going to destroy this corrupting pit of a city. But he seemed like he was jesting at the expense of others. From the vantage point of his sons-in-law, just kidding around. That's the normality factor. Those that recognize that American currency has been so badly debased and devalued that it's only faith that is creating a pretense that your money has some value. That and the fact that it's the foreign reserve currency, and that the Federal Reserve, when it couldn't sell any more T-bills, used smoke and mirrors with quantitative easing, creating the illusion of money to borrow the money to lend to the government that was $20 trillion in debt. The normalcy factor makes it very difficult for someone to perceive a world at war again or a world where chaos reigns, or a world where their currency has no value. Well, these fellas couldn't envision God destroying their place. Hey, man, it was a happening joint. It was party hardy here, man. So the normalcy factor caused them to think, yeah, no, things are going to be just the same tomorrow morning as they were yesterday morning. You know, come on, get out of here. The normalcy factor. It's very difficult for people to get beyond that. So if you tell people, listen, the world as you know it, you know, in less than 15 years is gone. They won't even process it. It's not in their realm of understanding. That's basically what these guys were saying. Now you just get going. Go away. You're testing. All right, so which words were there in there that...
No, I wasn't thinking about that one near as much as the one that's following, so other than...
Okay.
When I look them up, is you'd be surprised. Right down to the preposition, he tells the same story. It's amazing. Anyway, if we go to the next...
Is shuck ock, which is making a mockery of himself by engaging in foreplay. They're playing around with them and perhaps even fooling with them. It's a word that is a variation of it. Is in Yahweh's was applied to Yahweh. Dode says it of it. It's inferring that God's mocking man. And that's a really harsh thing for us to fathom. But he's at the midst of these political and military and conspiratorial promoters in the last days, and they're full of themselves, and God's just laughing at them. Oh, come on. You know, it's like a cutworm saying to the elephant, ha, 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 I'm going to get you. Squish. All right, so here's the next statement then, Kirk. As the sun rose, then the spiritual messengers, the Malachim, eagerly and energetically urged, being animate, who, responding to the circumstances in a way which encouraged hurrying away, speaking sternly but forcefully, being insistent with Lot, the enveloped and entangled, by saying, get up, rise up, and choose of your own volition to stand up, cum. Grasp hold of your wife and of your two daughters who have been discovered here, lest you be swept away in the perversity and resulting punishment of the city.
What
did you find?
Well, here was what was fun, as I'm looking back to confirm what you're saying. It's not that I'm concerned that you're not doing it right. I'm going, wow, you know, I kind of try to look at it independently and just look up the words and say, gosh, they mean this and they mean this and so forth. And like Shakar, obviously it's usually translated dawn and daybreak, and that's fine.
But
I look at the verb, and as a verb, it means to, it's a dark place, darkened color. It's to peer into the dim light of morning in search of something. A place of the rising sun, which it was. I found it also, it means to be charred, which is what's about to happen in a few, you know, right after they leave.
Yes.
And then if you look at all the letters, this once again is the... It's a language word for neutral, you know, it's a shin and a chet,
right,
and a resh. And all those bear the same thing, is to seek diligently, earnestly, seeking early at any, you know, at any task, whether you're searching for painfully, because now that doesn't seem like much what I just said, but this is what the angels are going to, or the Malach are going to be doing. Trying to rouse everybody, get out of the place, we're going now. And what I find so interesting is every little aspect of every little word, if you look deep enough, it reinforces the story.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about Shakar, which, of course, that is Satan's last name. It's Hillel or Halal.
Ben
Shakar. Right. But one of the interesting things about Shakar is that while it's not unique, totally unique, but there's no verb in it. Excuse me, there's no vowel in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's three consonants.
Right.
H, the CH, and the Roche. And, you know, Yahweh's name is comprised of four vowels. And Shakar is comprised of three consonants.
Well, that's an interesting take.
Yeah.
You're good.
So it's just it's the opposite, if you will.
Yeah.
But the human perspective, which hems in with words. You know, if you're reading it from right to left, the Rosh would be the human perspective, and then the CH is to hem in, to bind in, to enclose, but to hem in with the words. It's the Shin.
Yeah.
So the human perspective, to be hemmed in, bound in, confined, imprisoned, if you will, in words. It's a long, long way from Hayan and Yahweh, isn't it?
You ain't kidding. Let me move down to another one and just get your take on it. This Shafar, or Yogi, and that's the one that was really took a little bit of time because he just kept on giving. Is to be consumed like food crushed by your teeth. If you look at it, the letters, you know, is the edge or conclusion of something. You can look at it that way. As a word, you can look as, but it means from Shafar, to be snatched away. And immediately when I see snatched away, I start thinking of the Pauline term for the rapture, because I don't remember where I found it, but Yah does speak of that in the sense that there's a wolf snatching away its prey and devouring it later in the evening, which is the way Paul was. That would be the Pauline rapture. Boom, destroyed, joined, scattered, removed. Shofar, interestingly enough, from the part of the word, is also the only thing I've added. The only thing that's added in Shofar is you put a wah in between the Chemek and the hay. And that means a whirlwind, a circular wind that devours. Well, then you think of all the destruction that's being done with a whirlwind. We know of two right off the top of our heads. We've got the whirlwind that destroyed the Egyptian army when they came across to attack Moshe across the water. And then you've got the whirlwind at the very end that we talked about not too long ago, talking about the future time when he's going to blow all the Muslim antagonist away. And so maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that, you know, by word association, I look at this and I see this and I see that and I see that and I say, gosh,
yeah, this is the word that is lest you be swept up and away. Shafar. Yeah, to be so, you know, it's what's interesting here is that the way that it was phrased.
Yes.
You know, grasp hold of your wife and your two daughters, who have been discovered here.
Yeah.
So they didn't come for the wife or two daughters.
No, they had. They wasn't
they just,
on the
They
map.
Just happened to be here. And and the Malakim were able to figure out that Lot wasn't leaving without them. And their job was to get Lot out before they destroyed it. They could not destroy it without getting Lot out because Yahweh had made that promise to Abraham. And they couldn't keep from destroying it because the Malach were taking orders from Yahweh, and Yahweh's instructions were get Lot out and then destroy the place. So they just happened to be discovered there. They were going along for the ride.
Yeah.
And then, right, and then what it says, lest you be swept up and away. Well, there's nobody being swept up and away in Sodom and Gomorrah.
No,
I'm
going to
tell you, when the sky opens up and there's a brimstone, which are these sulfuric rocks that are burning so hot, they burn blue. So it's sulfur ignited, burning blue, that is a rock form. So imagine a hailstorm, but the hail, rather than being the size of maybe your thumbnail, is coming down and it's the size of a 50-cent piece. And it's this ball of rock, not ice, and it's on fire and burning at a temperature that it boggles the mind, blue heat. And the sky opens up with this. Is there anybody there being swept up and away?
No, they're all being pulled.
No.
Burned up.
So what that means is that the souls of those who are there are being swept up and away. They're being snatched away. This is the Pauline rapture concept of raptus in Greek, meaning to violently snatch away. These souls are being raptured. You know, maybe I was wrong. This is the story of a rapture.
So,
being snatched away to Sheol. That's what this means. You're right. Shafa means to be snatched away, to be captured, to be discarded.
Well,
none of these people were physically, they were not snatched away. They were not physically captured. They were not physically discarded. They were bombarded right there. This is like what you witness in Pompeii and Herculaneum, where,
yes,
you know, there's now they can, you know, under that that the molten lava and the everything, the ash that was there, the cavities of where the bodies were, because the bodies were there and then they were covered with this hot material and the bodies disintegrated, but it left the void where the bodies were. And they're all there. You know, huddled in their little corners, they're all there. That's the same thing with Sodom and Gomorrah, except for the fact that the physical bodies aren't there. They were burned up. They were incinerated, which means it's the souls of those people which weren't being simply annihilated, but found themselves being snatched away and incarcerated. They're experiencing the Pauline rapture.
Well, if you like a lapse, let me tell you what it means. I mean, ecstasis is the word he used, and that means I've never looked this up before. And it says displacement. It's a displacement of the mind caused by shock, bewilderment, distraction, and trance. Don't sound like much of a harvest to me. There's three different parts to it as well. Then another source, it says any casting down of a person or a thing from its place or state, displacement. I don't think we're going to be cast down. We're supposed to be being lifted up.
All right.
An alienation of the mind such that makes one a lunatic.
Wow.
A state of fear and wonder. Ecstasis. And then from extemi, the verb, to be removed from a standing position. Well, I think we want to be upright. We don't want to be removed from our standing position.
That's right. So you actually went to what Paul wrote, and it's been so long since my Greek is really rusty. And, of course, raptus is from the Latin translation of what Paul wrote. But the actual term for the violent snatching away that Paul talked about is very telling.
Yeah. There's nothing good about this.
It's perfect for this occasion, because what Paul wrote about in terms of his rapture is exactly what's happening here, but to those who are being sent to Sheol.
Yeah.
To those left. And then the word for perversity and resulting punishment is aewon. And, you know, there's about 15 different words in Hebrew that are all translated sin or wickedness in English Bibles. And you'll notice in my translations, I've almost never used the word sin.
Mm-hmm.
Almost never. And I very seldom use the term wickedness. And evil is another one of them, and I'll use evil on occasion, but it's going to be buried in the translation.
Yeah.
Because there is a common denominator in all of the Hebrew words for that are rendered evil, wicked, or sin. And the two common denominators are perversion, twisting, corrupting, and wrong. The single most common denominator of every Hebrew word that is rendered sin or evil or wicked is wrong. The antithesis of tzedak. Dode was right. These folks are wrong. Aewon, if you were to render aewon accurately, what you would have is perversity, to pervert and therefore to be wrong, resulting in punishment.
Yeah.
But that's what they all boil down to. So, aewon means to be wrong, contrary a contrarian, serpentine crookedness, a propensity to twist, to corrupt, to pervert. And then the city is hot ear, and then ear means everything from city to anguishing shrines and temples, terrorizing asses, displeasing inhabitants.
And I found all of those. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, if you're wondering about whether to trust these translations, my gosh, the more you'll find, you'll just be delighted when you go there. You'll find, wow, that's really, really, really it.
Yeah, my experience is that if you take these translations and you check them, rather than being delighted that, they're accurate, what you'll be delighted in is how much more you can learn.
Yeah, well, that's...
As amplified as these all are, there's still more there.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to read the reason that the Malakam provided for Lot's wife and daughters accompanying them out of town is that they simply were matzah. They were discovered there. As such, their removal was not by design, not based upon Yah's instructions, not based on familial love. Moreover, in the next statement, we discover that the Malakam overpowered Lot to make certain that he was not left in Sodom with the women and his life tagging along. But the most telling phrase is that Yahweh's mercy was directed exclusively towards Lot and not the women about to become salt nor the incestuous daughters.
Isn't that
also? Yeah, it really is. And they don't even have names. Also,
I noticed that too. I was going to look up the names, and I can't...
Now, what's interesting is that their offspring have names because it's the offspring of
product of that
Sodom
union
that matters. Because now we're dealing with what really matters is the name of the offspring. What is the outgrowth of Sodom and Amorah?
Yeah.
But for reasons entirely his own. Isn't this interesting? For reasons entirely his own, he hesitated. This is the hit by L, imperfect. Hit by L means acting on his own initiative with ongoing consequences. For reasons entirely his own, he hesitated. He foolishly delayed. He tried to extend his time, and showing a lack of understanding, he lingered. From ma to question the who, what, why, when, where, and how of something. As man standing. The question really is man standing is what they're questioning. Mm-hmm. The individuals, meaning the two spiritual implements, Waha-ish, powerfully and harshly seized him by the hand. This is blowing the living tar out of the idea of angels being these cute little girls with wings.
No, they get the job done, don't they?
All right. They were sent to do a job. They're going to get a job. The individuals, meaning the two spiritual implements, powerfully and harshly seized him by the hands. Shazak ba yad hu. Severely overpowered him and established their control over his hands firmly with intense resolve. And then with the hand of his wife and the hand of his two daughters, with Yahweh being merciful unto him. Not them. And they brought them out and spiritually placed them apart from and outside so as to sever ties to the approach to the city. So why do you think Lot hesitated?
He wasn't on the page yet. He still left it there.
Yeah, he couldn't
fathom it. Sure, and you know, he ran away. He took the first opportunity to get away from Abraham, although he has no life without Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
But
you know, we can talk until we're blue in the face to religious people about this is who God is, this is what he's offering, this is what he's asking of us, what he's going to give us in return. And they're going to hesitate. They're going to hesitate. No, you know, life's pretty good, you know. I'm got two cars in the garage, I got a chicken in my pot, got a dog at my feet, you know, I got a couple of kids, yeah, they're a little cranky, but got a job, you know. I can't imagine the life's good. I don't need what you're offering. I hesitated.
Yeah.
Happens all the time, doesn't it? God's brilliantly presenting the greatest offer ever given to humankind, and most people do a Lot. They hesitate. So the fact that Lot is hesitating is instructive of what happens when we tell people the same story. You know, the sky's going to fall in. The earth as you know it is corrupt. It's wrong. It's going to be destroyed. You need to get out of Dodge. And there's only one ticket out of this place. And what do? They hesitate.
Yeah.
And so in this particular case, Lot was seized by the hand, and they dragged him out of town. Now, God's not going to do that with anybody else. He's only doing that because he made a promise to Abraham.
Mm-hmm. You have to fulfill it.
Yep. And brought them out spiritually and placed them in a place that was set apart from the city. So, it's important here to recognize that the Malach, they're not acting on free will. Volition all over the place. And yet you never once see volition conveyed or projected on a Malach. But constantly being applied to people. This reaffirms the nature of the Sabbath, wherein we recognize that they're just following orders. And this is why they, Jazak, harshly overpowered Lot. Yad had given them a directive, and they were going to carry it out. Certainly blows away, of course, the myth of angels being sweet, pretty little girls with wings. Now, it follows and is really clear and contextual. It's a real-world explanation of what God is seeking. He wants and desires from all of us, whether we have lived in an ancient or modern Sodom, antiquity's Babel, or today's incarceration of our incarnation, I should say, of Babylon. And it came to pass as they brought them outside, severing ties. Then one said, "Of your own volition, flee and spare your soul. It is his desire that you do not look back, nor have any regard for what you've left behind. In addition, it is his intent that you do not take a stand or abide standing still with anyone in the broad and open way or with anything associated with around us. Choose to escape to the mount, lest you be swept away." Now, for the religious person, all they get out of this is, don't look back. God's going to turn you into a pillar of salt. Don't look back. And it's like the whole thing is God was a cosmic killjoy. He's going to have the fireworks show of all fireworks show in the history of humanity, and he's a killjoy. I don't want them to enjoy it.
But that's what it means. It's a lot more than that.
Oh, of course.
When you look it out, it's to consider, like carefully consider, thus observe. It even says in the definitions, observe. Don't depend. It's something that you depend upon. You closely examine. You carefully consider. You gaze on with regard. You regard with respect, pleasure, and something that you care for. Well, if you want it, then keep it. You know, that's
right.
Yahweh was trying to save your life, and yes, what you go to it. Just like he said when he sent them off to Babylon, if you want to do religious stuff, not here.
They really don't. Straightforward. They brought them outside, severing ties. Walk away from Babel. Walk away from the corruption of religion and politics. Walk away from that stuff. They brought them outside, severing ties. Then one said, "Of your own volition, flee and spare your soul." You want to spare your soul? The first step on sparing your soul is disassociating from religion and politics. If you don't take that step, nothing you do matters. You have to take that first step. And if you don't take that first step, God's not going to introduce himself to you. you are never going to come to know him. No one has ever ended up in heaven that hasn't taken the step away from religion and politics. That's exactly what's being presented here. God doesn't ever miss an opportunity to teach us the single most important lesson in life. Step away, walk away from Babel, from religion and politics, from man's perverted and twisted wrong realm of Sodom. And then he just, for emphasis, said, of your own volition, flee and spare your soul. It's the only way you can spare your soul. You know, you can't spare your life. We're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
But you can spare your soul. And the means to do that, the first step, is to disassociate from religion and politics. Then the Balak explain, not their desire. They're speaking for God. God has free will. And they said, it is his desire. How many times do you hear Christians say, I want to know the will of God? Well, here it is laid out for you. Just understand the Hebrew grammar and you got it. This was written in the Hifl imperfect jussive. The subject engages the object such that they become similar with ongoing implications based upon the will of another.
Yes, speaker's desire.
Yes. So, it is his desire, Joseph, that you do not look back nor have any regard for what you have left behind. You know, you could just say, don't look behind. Don't look over your shoulder. Don't look back. But if you, even if you write it, don't look back, you've eliminated the purpose of the Joseph. It's there for a reason. It expresses third-person volition. It's his desire that you do not look back or have any regard for what you have left behind. That is the primary meaning of the word. Expressing the intent of the one who has sent us, it is his will that you no longer respect, that you should cease to care about the others, no longer interpreting your understanding from your past. In addition, it is his intent that you don't take a stand or abide or stand still. And this is Al-Amad, with anyone in the broad and open way. Ba-Kol-Ha-Kikar. With anyone, don't take a stand, don't remain, don't have any regard for anyone in the broad and open way. But when you read, and of course in the English translation it just says valley. What is God against? God's got nothing against valleys. It's not that they want, don't you want to linger in the valley? God's got nothing against valleys. The broad and open way. What does that mean? Where have we heard that before?
Well, that was the downtown in this chapter. Where was the downtown where they were going to reside? Remember, they came in and said, we're going to stay downtown in the broad and open way. It is the big path where everybody goes down instead of the narrow path.
Right. Yeah, it's, Yosha's... Listen, there's not a lot in the Greek accounts that you can say, you know, I'm going to take that to the bank. That's what God said. Well, I want to tell you, since Matanya, Matthew 5, 6, and 7 obliterate the religion of Christianity, there is no chance whatsoever that was edited to obliterate the religion, unless God actually said it and they were saying, oh my God, this is his longest speech. I'm going to get whacked if I change a word of this. So even though it's in Greek, I want to leave it the way it was. You've got nothing that even comes close to being as likely to be trustworthy as that. And in that, Yosha is laying out the broad and open way and the narrow and unpopular way. And he says that the broad and open way leads to the death and destruction of one soul. And the narrow and restrictive way, the unpopular way, leads to life. whole purpose of this section is, don't think for a second that I have come to obliterate the Torah and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. Well, context. Why would he say that? Why would he begin the single most important speech he would ever make saying, don't think I'm here to annul or to obliterate or to do away with the Torah?
Everybody missed it.
Yeah, and everybody missed it.
Sorry, this is really...
They still missed it because there was a guy who was likely even in the audience, who was a rabbi, who would be possessed by his own admission by Satan, who would come to annul the Torah and create a religion of Christianity based upon doing away with the Torah and replacing it by the Pauline gospel of grace and salvation through faith. And so the very first thing God says, don't think that I've come to do away with the Torah. Haven't. I've come to fulfill it. And then just in case you would be stupid enough to think that fulfilling a promise, fulfilling something, means to do away with it, he says, not a single stroke of a single letter that comprises the Torah will be annulled so long as the heavens and earth exist. Pretty straightforward that fulfilling doesn't mean to do away with, does it?
Hardly.
And so the broad and open way, it's the way of that religion that was based on that guy that said, I'm doing away with the Torah. And broad and open? Well, if your religion is based upon faith, you can't have anything more open than that, can you?
Do anything you want.
It's not based on facts, not based on Yahweh's testimony, it's not based on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, not even based on Yosha, because, well, he was Torah observant, and they're not.
Yeah.
So open, you can't be any more open than faith. Just believe.
Trust me, said the salesman.
And broad means popular.
Yes.
In all of human history, there has never been a religion anywhere close to as popular is Christianity. Nor has there ever been a religion whose entire method of salvation was by faith. Broad and open way.
Yeah. Is it because they're asleep, or is it because they just love it so?
I think that most of it is that they have been told so many times that their Bibles are the inerrant word of God, or their church is Christ's vicar on earth, and that the Pope's the holiest man on earth, and that the religion, therefore, because it's so popular, can't be wrong, that they don't even question the most ridiculous. You know, I was driving today. I fulfilled the prophecy, didn't I? I was driving today, and I went by a church that had this big stained glass window. Yeah, I'm not a prophet, Kirk. I didn't tell you that. I predicted that I was going to get in the car today, and I did. I'm just spoofing, of course. Driving by this huge stained glass window, and it was dead God on a stick. It was a picture of tortured and dead God hanging on a Roman cross. And I just wanted to stop and say, your God must just love you. Memorialized man killing your God. Not just man killing your God, but your God tortured before he died. And you've got him stuck there on that stupid death stake. You don't have the decency to take him down. What the hell is wrong with you? Dead God on a stick. And so, you know, here's God saying, it's his will that you don't look back and you have no regard for what you left behind. And in addition, it's his intent that you don't take a stand, abide with, stand still with anyone in the broad and open way. And, of course, you looked up Kikar, you'll find that Kikar is the same word that was rendered circles.
Yes.
In English. And it's the same word that we get church. God doesn't have a church. In the Greek even, it's ecclesia, to call out. When Yosha spoke about it in Hebrew, it was mikra, and in the plural, mikrae. To be called out, to be invited, to meet, to be welcome, to read and recite. That's the word that Yosha used, is mikra and mikrae. And it was rendered to the, you know, straightforward, but crude, truncated translation of mikra and mikrae would be called out.
Well, you know, that's interesting.
And so, and rather than translating called out, ecclesia, the religion that Paul conceived simply chose a pagan goddess, Church, and changed it to church. And have fooled billions of people to think that God has a church. It's based on this lie right here, Kakar. I mean, circle.
Yeah, round.
And everything that throughout history that's been associated with solar disks, from those round loaves of bread that, of course, Catholics eat as their part of their Eucharist, and as Christians have as part of their communion.
Mm-hmm.
The round cake that were so popular with Asherah worship.
Yes.
Circuitous reasoning, venting the truth, disc coinage, whirling around, dancing in circles, all of it's kakar. It's the Greek word, excuse me, the Hebrew word that is closest to the basis of church. So don't do that. It's his will that you don't do that. Choose to escape. And he says, choose to escape, as opposed to getting lost in these churches, as opposed to having any regard for what you've left behind, choose to escape to the mount, lest you be swept away.
Article, the mount.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now we know it's Moriah.
Ha har. And by the way, you know, there's a plural and singular form of this word. He used the singular. It was the mount. He didn't say, you know, head to the hills. No. He didn't say, you know, hijack it into the mountains. You know, you got to get it out of this valley. Go up to the mountains. No, that's not what he said. The mount. Do you know where Sodom is?
I saw it near
Shores of the Dead Sea. Do you know where the Dead Sea, and it's on the western shore of the Dead Sea. If you're standing with your back to the Dead Sea, standing, because you can look down, you can see the ruins of Sodom to this day. You can go pick up the brimstone. It's all over the place right there. You can actually burn it. It burns blue. If you're back to the Dead Sea and you're looking west, because it's on the western shore of the Dead Sea, mm-hmm. What are you looking at?
Jerusalem, I assume. Oh, you're Mamara.
Yeah, absolutely. You're looking at, straight ahead of you is the Mount of Olives. And just past the Mount of Olives is Mount Moriah. And they're really close together. But you're looking at Mount of Olives. If you're standing on the top of Mount of Olives, you're looking down. You know, remember when Yahweh and Abraham were looking down? Well, they were hanging out right there at around Moriah. And, in fact, if you're looking down, you're on Olives. And that's where they're looking down at. So the mount? Oh, Moriah. Mount Zion.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Which is the roof line of Moriah.
Now, well, why didn't anybody find that for 3,000 years? Even that mystery, ain't it? They don't care.
I think Kirk, you have described this many times, and it's a kind of a southern colloquialism. But mm-hmm. The thing that they lack that you have and they don't have is the want to.
Yeah, the want to.
You know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that as exciting as it is to see these insights as thrilled as we are when we uncover them and get to share them, they weren't hidden. They were there all the time. Anybody with the want to could have found anything that we have found. You just got to have the want to.
I've known so many people. I'm going to Bible study. I'm going to study, you know, and I didn't know half of it when I started, or you know, even just tenth of it, or 1% of it. But I knew enough to know a lot of this stuff has to be wrong. So you couldn't fool me with it's an errant word of God. I said something right here.
Well, just think of going to Bible study, Kirk.
Yeah, I know.
What is
BBL.
You know, you want to understand that the evolution of words, you look at their letter root. Most ancient words are comprised of three letters. And there's ones that are actually compounds of different thoughts that'll have four, five, six, and seven letters. But the preponderance of Hebrew words are comprised of three letters. Now, we'll write them out as more simply because we're transliterating them. But, for example, this lest you be swept away, the Shafa, three letters. What are the three letters in Bible that would be the ancient letters? BBL, right?
BBL.
How is Babel spelled?
Does it have
B-B-L?
An A in it? Or?
Yeah, BBL.
Okay, fair enough.
BBL. What does it mean? With the Lord.
With the Lord.
Yeah, and what does Babel mean? Confusion.
Yeah.
So intermix, and so as to confuse. That's what Christianity is, a mix of the Babylonian religion and the Assyrian religion and the Greek religion, a lot of the Greek religion, a little Roman religion, the names, they love the Latin names. That's what it is.
Well, I think the people that offend me the most are the ones who actually go to college for this.
Yeah.
And get a doctorate degree in divinity.
Yeah, they still can't think it through.
Yeah,
know a lot of stuff and understand nothing. First, we discovered that from God's perspective, being brought outside was symbolic of severing ties with the libertine world of Sodom. Second, our willingness, so long as it's of our own free will, to walk away from man's moral morass initiates the process by which our souls are spared, delivering that which is most dear by escaping human babble. It is what eventually leads us through all of the birth pangs to being born anew as a child in the covenant. But the highlight of this statement is al-nabat akar ata, the realization that it is the desire of the one who dispatched the Malak, that he does not want us to look back, longing for our former lives. I mean, what is more miserable to God? He's created this extraordinary eternal experience for us, where we're set apart from man's world, and we're part of his family, and we've thrown off all of the muck and myth of religion that is so disgusting and so emasculating and debilitating, and we've thrown it all off, and now we're celebrating our life with him. The last thing he wants is somebody to say, boy, wasn't that religious stuff great? Didn't you just love singing those Christmas carols? Well, those Easter egg hunts we used to have, man, that was really, really special and fun. Didn't you really love that that sermon at the Easter sunrise service? God says, don't look back. Well, I just love the 4th of July and the fireworks shows. That was really spectacular. I long for that. Oh, this is Memorial Day weekend here in America. Let's worship our military.
Thank God bless America, at least.
You know, America exists today because of the sacrifice of our soldiers. No, it doesn't. There isn't a single soldier in America that died so that we would have freedom. Not one. So we are just now ended the broadcast portion of the show. so it's still recording. I think we can continue to fill in the commentary on this particular passage, and then we'll start again afresh a week from now. So I think that's the highlight of this, that God does not want us to look back, longing for our former life, showing any regard for what we have left behind when we choose to live with him. I think it was, Kirk, you were the first one to say this in a really just blunt, succinct way, which is that the five requirements of the covenant, the five terms and conditions of the covenant, we don't give up anything, really.
No, that's right.
Walking away from religion and politics and conspiracy and the like, we don't give up anything in that, in the babble of it, economic schemes and societal corruption. Once you come to know what those things really are and how they're just egotistical men conniving for their own self-interest and power. It's like, you know, all the people that died in fighting wars, they didn't die to keep America free. No, they died because politicians made some stupid decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once you come to have an appreciation of that, you realize you're not giving up anything when you distance yourself from religion and politics. You don't give up anything when you choose to trust and rely on Yahweh instead. You're not giving up anything along the way when you come to know, for example, the terms and conditions of the covenant.
But your brain also, Craig, your brain becomes alive. It's like you see things clearly, logically, how it put all pieces together, and it's like all of a sudden, I'm not confused anymore. I mean, that's a lot to be said for. I trust you, I've walked away, and now I'm looking at you, and I'm going, wow, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Yahweh's promises and teaching, and that, then all of a sudden you go, this is brilliant.
Exactly.
It's real.
Correct.
Sorry, go ahead.
And that's basically what God is saying here. I don't want you looking back and longing for the Christmas carols or the Easter egg hunts or the 4th of July picnics, you know, for the, you know, the inspiration that you got when you walked into your nation's capital. Don't be looking back. You know, Lot's wife wouldn't be turned to salt because she couldn't keep from looking, but because she really didn't want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
We can cling to man's world or flee it to engage in God's, but we can't bring one into the other. Now, further, driving this point home, these Malak messengers are reinforcing the idea that it is Yahweh's intent that we do not continue to abide within or take a stand in favor of anyone in the broad and open way, with anything associated with that which is expansive, popular, inclusive, including the global community, that which is related to the round sundae disc loaf bread or the religious cakes, because it's akin to whirling around and dancing in circles. A friend shared an article with me the other day. It was a video, and I was asked to watch it. You know what I think about videos, so I watched about 20 seconds of it and then, you know, turned into a pretzel. But it was this hijab-wearing Muslim woman who was at a Catholic college carrying around a little prayer mat. And the leaders of this Catholic university saying how wonderful it was that they could invite her in because, you know, we're all worshiping the same God. And we open up a classroom for her to pray five times a day. And the Catholics are just so impressed with her devotion to her God through her and her commitment to prayer, and that this is really just a wonderful thing that we have done. And she said, you know, how the Catholics have, because of their devotion to the religion, have been inclusive. And of course, the Pope has signed not long ago with the head of Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the number one Islamic university in the world, we are all brothers pact. and that there should be no exclusion in religion, that we're all one big family. That's what he's talking about here. That's the broad and open way. It's inclusive. And God's saying, if you're part of something that's inclusive, multiculturalism, for example, is inclusive. If you're part of something that's inclusive, that is popular, God wants you to know that you're going to be snatched away too. And you're not going to like where you're going. This is a really stunningly, I mean, it's just a simple statement as they're heading out of Dodge, out of Sodom. And it has got everything we need to know about God's view of man's way versus his way, of God's will. You want to save your soul? Disassociate from this stuff and don't look back. What I've got is so much better. You want to see what I've got? Come to the Mount.
You know,
most English Bibles, I ignore coal and render Kakar as valley, when one is essential and the other is errant. Kakar is the basis of circle, of circular, of circuitous, of circus, of circumvent in modern Western languages. The circle is symbolic of the sun and the moon, God religions and astrology, Christianity and Islam. Circular reasoning is the circuitous approach to life and to God is symbolic of religion and politics, beginning with Babel. The name church, as I mentioned, was derived from this root, Kikar. And it's an institution designed to circumvent the will of God. Kikar can also be conveyed as global and global, dislike, with the former addressing the planet and the latter representing communion and the Eucharist wafer. You know, finally, the instruction wasn't to escape to the hills, as I mentioned, because Har was singular and it was prefaced by the definite article. Recognizing that it would have been looming right above them, the mount that Lot ought to have sought should have been Moria. It was the place symbolically for us and in reality for Abraham, for Dode, for Yosha, Yahweh, to go to resolve the legacy of Sodom. It is where Yahweh will return to cleanse the stain of politics and religion and also the stigma of man's fractured family. All missed. Why? Because, well, you can't sell a Bible if it reads differently than all the other Bibles that that people have had in the past. So they just continue to pump out the lies, and they call their Bibles the inerrant Word of God. You know, and you just shake your head. Well, how could it be inerrant if there are 300,000 known differences between the oldest manuscripts and the basis of English translations today? Only 184,000 words, you got 300,000 known variations. How can it be inerrant? It's the opposite. So if your faith requires you to ignore reality, then maybe you've got some holes in your faith. And how can it be inerrant if every word that Paul wrote contradicts what God had to say? If your front of your book and the end of your book are opposites, how could it be inerrant? I mean, to believe Paul, you've got to have your God be an error machine. Everything God said has to be erroneous if what Paul wrote is true. Yeah. And what Paul wrote can't be true if anything God wrote was erroneous, much less everything. It's not that hard to figure out.
You know, it has to be something, because you've said so many times that you have to go through the peace out door by yourself. Nobody can push you through. I can't help you through. You can't help me through. You have to make a decision and walk that path and go through that and celebrate those mikvahs and delight in them. Christianity never gave me that impression. It was all like, we're all family, we're going to help you through, and we're all going to pray for you, and da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, it must be that, to some degree, for some of them. They just won't give up. You have to be brave, I guess. I don't think so, because that makes all sense to me, so I never give it a thought. I just say, sure, go.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be stupid. Of course, guys, the door, go.
Yes.
It must be comforting, just so comforting. But I was always kind of a little bit of an outsider anyway, so I guess I didn't relate to that as much. You know, so.
Yeah. It's you mentioned the word pray. The halal is the Hebrew word that is rendered pray, and of course it doesn't mean pray. But as I translate these first, our initial mizmor, one of the things that you learn is that Dod is pretty vocal with Yahweh. You know, he's saying, Yahweh, I want you to listen to me. We got some issues here. It's important that you listen to me. It's important that you respond appropriately. And I'm counting on it.
But you're talking about things that Yahweh loves.
Oh, of course. You know, you can tell God anything that's blunt and bold. You can say, hey, God, you can't exclude me from heaven because I'm coming with the Torah.
Yeah.
I've accepted the terms and conditions of the covenant, so I'm coming in.
I love that line.
So, I can say, God, you've got no choice but to save Israel. None. And guess what? He's not offended by that. He says, of course, that's what I wrote. That's what I said. That's what I'm going to do. And that's what Dod does, man. Dod is just saying, these are things that you've committed to do. I've taken the time to study your Torah, and now I'm holding you accountable. You know, an honorable individual, and God's honorable, doesn't mind. In fact, loves being held accountable. It's a good thing.
Well, if you're a teacher, they're repeating back what they're saying to you. I know what you said. And that was
yes.
The whole point of all the teaching, the Yara.
Yes, I know what
really?
You said.
On every level.
Right. Yes. And the other thing is that when you're playing for keeps, God's playing for keeps, this is no game.
No.
And you got somebody that's willing to stand up and make a difference and say, all right, let's do this, but let's do this together. And let's
mm-hmm.
give them both barrels.
Mm-hmm.
The full 9 yards in World War II speak. God appreciates that. And so there's a lot of it. So this idea that people make their long wish lists to God, they have their long prayers, God has not listened to one of them. He has no interest in listening to what somebody wants who doesn't even want to listen to him. But if you're like Dod, if you like those of us who prioritize our relationship and study his word and devote the time to getting to know him, he wants to know what you have to say. You know, then it's a productive relationship, and I'm certain, Kirk, with Terry having this infection that her body's having a tough time fighting, that there's a lot of requests. And it's wholly and completely appropriate. Once you're a part of his family, he wants to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
You know, the only time that you have a guarantee that what you're going to get back, that you're going to get back what you're asking, is when what you're asking is what he wants to do when you're in complete sync. And you know how Dod, when he's up in Yahweh's face and saying, hey, this is what I expect. I want you to listen. I want you to listen intently. I want you to respond appropriately. Every time he says it, it's in first and second person volition. Every time. So if it's in first and second person volition, that means that when Dod is speaking to Yahweh, their wills are in sync.
Yes.
They want exactly the same thing. Their motivations are the same. Their inclinations are the same. Their desires are the same. Their choices are the same. if you want what God wants, you can be really, really bold. And that's what he does. He makes all of his bold statements in first and second person volition.
Cool.
Pretty cool.
You don't want to take on the side next week.
Pardon?
In Psalms 1 at least.
Oh, I know, I know. And I'm sorry. You know, it's one of the things, too, that I'm terrible at is that I get so excited when I'm translating these things that I want to share what I'm learning as I'm learning it, because what is the purpose of learning this if you can't share it?
Yeah.
The joy of it is sharing it. And but you know what's interesting about sharing it is that you come to own it when you share it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a huge difference. I'm sure you found this in your translating and your looking up of words. It's one thing to read it. It's another thing to think about it. Another thing entirely to do an investigation on it. But then when you've done all of those things and then you put the pieces together and now you're going to share with somebody what you have learned, you come to own the material. It becomes, and by own I mean very positively, it becomes part of the fabric of your life.
Yes.
And so that's one of the reasons we share. Plus it's just joyous to do so.
It's fun.
The inspiration
wow.
is brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, really, you throw those teasers out and I go, wow.
Yeah. And I'll send you the, and you know, for those that are listening that want to jump in, very soon, in fact, this chapter already should be up and probably in a number of the sites that that have observations. And then very shortly, they'll put up volume one of, or volume three, chapter one. Which begins it, and then, I'm only, 15 pages into chapter two of volume three, so it'll take a while to finish it.
I know.
Yeah,
some,
of it's coming from that. Yeah.
Yeah,
just starting the fifth Mizmor, and then that chapter will go through the seventh Mizmor, and then I'm going to jump into... it'll probably be four or five chapters on the Yirmiyah chapters are really long, and I've started in 48 with the demise of Moab, and that's why we're in this chapter now.
Yeah.
You know, why did Yashaiah prior to giving us the timeline for the last days and precisely what's going to happen and how the Teruah harvest happens and how Israel becomes vulnerable by being narrowed at the waist and how all that's precipitated by the fall of Damascus and the Syrian war and the like, and then the Magog war and the flooding of Islamic jihadists into Israel, and the two chapters of Yashaiah that preceded is the fall of Moab. And so that's why we're doing this. This is the purpose we're doing that is that Yirmiyah and Yashaiah collectively devote three entire chapters to the fall of Moab in the last days.
And it's
Ezekiel.
Right. It's,
yes.
Why is this? There's a nothing place.
Right.
Why did this happen? So,
right.
Look what
it runs throughout the prophets.
Yeah.
And there isn't a single prophet that's writing about Moab as Moab exists. Moab ceased to exist, and we're going to get into the story. The destruction of Moab is among the most enlightening and riveting stories, one of the most repulsive stories that I have ever translated.
Yes, I read some.
It really tears your heart out.
Mm-hmm.
Not at Moab's demise, because Moab was one of those cultures that was extraordinarily into human sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, Mishnah, the king who we found the Mishnah stone, not only did he sacrifice his own son, burning him alive on the wall of the city to appease his god, he sacrificed 10,000 Moabites,
God,
people. To their god. So this guy was, and that where the world's better off without them. But just because the world's better off without them, yet the way Yisrael establishes the conspiracy that would come back to haunt them, and then God says, you know, you can do whatever you want to, Moab. It's your call. But I want you to understand that what you do to them will be done to you. And so it has been. We're going to find that that story will tear your heart out. But it's essential to understand what's happened to Yisrael and the relationship between Yisrael and Moab, and also how 950 BCE is when Moab was destroyed.
Yes.
And yet all of these prophecies are taking place circa 2027 to 2033.
Mm-hmm.
So 3,000 years later. And they were recorded, you know, 150, 200 years after Moab was gone. So it's kind of like me predicting that, you know, I'm going to go to the store tomorrow and I predict, prophesy that I'm going to ride in a car. It's like saying, you know, the king of Israel is going to ride on a donkey. But, you know, the deal with Moab is that they were long, long gone at the time that they were predicted to be demised. And there's no such thing as a prophecy that's going to say, I predict Moab will be destroyed. And oh, by the way, they were destroyed 150 years before I wrote that. And what's also interesting is that one of the predictions of Moab's destruction says that it can occur in a single night.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the time of day was when Moab was actually destroyed?
Probably noon.
No, early morning. Probably. It was all because they were told to dig some trenches and Yasser fill them with water, and because they were on the east side of Moab. When the sun rose in the morning, which, by the way, puts them in Moabite territory, not in Israel from that perspective, so that's really an interesting perspective. But when the sun rose in the morning, the Moabites, who were looking east, which is what in the world, since Moab is east of Yisrael, what was Yisrael doing, such that they were on the east side of Moab, but nonetheless, that's the telling in itself. The Moabites saw the rising sun glistened on the water, and the rising sun and the setting sun are red. And so they thought it was blood. And they said, oh, these guys, they've gone after each other. So since they've killed each other and they've got now, you know, rivers of blood there, we'll just go steal what they brought there. We'll get their weapons and, you know, we'll steal the booty. That was first thing in the morning, sunrise. Of course, the prophecy says they'll be, you know, done in one night. No, it was done in at sunrise. So the ancient destruction is not what it was covering. It's funny too that the Mishnah, the king, you know, that Moabite stone, the Mishnah stone, the seal.
Mm-hmm.
He claims victory.
Of course.
His entire kingdom was destroyed. Killed his own son. Everybody. The Israelites only left because they'd wiped out everything. In fact, they not only wiped everything, they plugged up all water supplies, they cut down every tree, they took all the aerial land and they covered it with rocks. And they killed all the people. Nothing left. I mean, literally nothing left of Moab. And so Mishnah declares victory on the Mishnah stone. Says, I really took it to him. Me and my God, we really took it to him. It's kind of like Saddam Hussein saying that that he won the mother of all battles.
Shake your hand again and go get in your hole.
Then go hide in your hole. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll hopefully have JB back celebrating now his new job, and we'll pick it up with Barbara Sheets, 1919.
1919. All right.
Yep. That's when when Lote said unto them, "No, I beg you." This is so much interesting. "I beg you, my lords, look here, please. If your associate has found favor in your sight, you have shown great kindness, which you have acted out with me. But I'm incapable of escaping by fleeing to the mount." And so the miserable attitude and the overt wrongdoing and the twisted perversions will cling to me and be associated with me, and I will die.
Well, they obviously didn't understand Monta.
That the case?
Yeah.
Yeah, I said, no, it's just too much for me to make it all the way up to Moab. It's like telling people, you know, I want the shorter version. It's just too much for me to have to read all this. That's too much effort. I don't want to, you know, that's up that hill there. I mean, it's probably 1,500 feet vertical, maybe 2,000 feet. I'm not going up there.
Yeah.
No, too much effort.
Yeah.
Let me just hang down here. And I know that because I'm lazy here and I'm not going to make the effort, that all the perversity of the place I just left is going to cling to me. I got no hope of a better life.
What a fool.
Ah, well. So we'll see you this time next week.
Yes, sir. I'll be here.
All right. All right. Let's hope that Terry has a much better week this coming week. All right.
We will get there. Thank you so much.
All right. Good night, my friend.
Shalom. Good night.
Shalom.